el antifaz que tu maldad cubría.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon at The Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick, the 28th of July. Wow, summer is almost 1 month till it's over. Wow. Last week, we had the pleasure of meeting with and speaking with Dick Bessie, who is a bread maker, a fermentation specialist, and helped get the bread program here at Roberta's off the ground. So we are finishing today's conversation, or beginning today's conversation, with this discussion of yeast, wild yeast, commercial yeast, how it applies to bread making and wine making. So welcome back, Dick. Thanks for coming out again.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I think this is an interesting subject, particularly in these days where everyone is on that push for natural winemaking, you know, things that are sustainable, green, largely in line with what Heritage Foods champions. But the discussion of yeast, given that it's on its own path sometimes, is sometimes harder to control in a winery or in a business like bread making, for example.
Absolutely true. Absolutely.
But I know that when I went to a a seminar a couple months ago, and there were 12 German winemakers all in town, and one of the conversations that came up was, how many of you are using wild yeast? And yeast exists, and bacteria exists naturally on grapes, in grapes, and in the cellar itself. So there is that possibility of combining some use of wild yeast in the cellar with a synthetic yeast as well. But I think only one out of 12 of the winemakers had said that they experiment with wild yeast, and the other one said it's just too hard.
Yeah, no, there's an inherent risk in using natural leavening, you know, a sourdough kind of culture for bread, or using wild yeast for wine. As you say, there's yeasts of all kinds on grape skins, and if you crush wine or crush grapes, and you have the grape juice and skin sitting together, then some of those yeasts can do a terrific job of making really good wine. There are some serious risks involved in that if you're trying to make a living with a natural yeast, either bread making or with wine. One of the reasons that people, both in the baking and the winemaking industries, are using commercial starters or yeasts of one kind or another is that your results are pretty predictable. You know that at a given temperature and for a certain length of time, using whatever your yeast you're using, it will give you the sorts of results that you want and the sorts of results that you're used to getting. Whereas if you're using wild yeasts for making wine, you're crossing your fingers a little bit. You're admitting that you're sort of guiding things along. You're really not able to control it. You're just sort of pushing it one direction or another, and hoping that nature is sort of watching over you. And the guys that are doing wild yeast winemaking probably have some really sleepless nights for the first short period of time that fermentation is taking place, because if they wind up with a yeast that doesn't give them good flavor, or they wind up with something that doesn't kick off at all, then they've got an entire crop that is going to cause them, you know, serious financial heartburn. The same thing with sourdough, you know, naturally leavened breads. You're not forcing anything. You're simply letting nature take its course, and you have to pay a lot more attention to what you're doing. People who use commercial yeast in baking get very, very predictable results. They get very, very similar results. They also don't get as much flavor as you can get using the sourdough cultures, especially the one, you know, if you've got the ones like we talked about last week. When you have natural yeast, you also have the bacterial action that gives you the nice acid profile. It gives you all that nice flavor in a loaf of bread like that. So you have
But in bread, how do you decipher between natural yeast? I mean, I know that what is it existing on in bread? That if it's in the winery, it naturally is on the grape skins. When you're making bread, what does the natural yeast relate to?
If you have a bucket of wheat berries before you grind it up into flour, the outsides of those wheat berries have millions of little yeast cells on them.
Okay.
And you can actually make a sourdough starter by mixing a paste of water and flour and covering it up and going back and feeding it, you know, once or twice a day for a week or two. And if it doesn't start bubbling after a couple of days, you can throw it out and start over. But pretty soon you're going to come up with one where you've got nice bubbly appearance to it, and it smells like alcohol, just like you would expect a yeast to. But these are, by and large, they wouldn't be really dominant. If you mix wild yeasts with commercial yeast, the commercial yeast very aggressively take over the culture.
Right.
It's what makes the predictability part of winemaking, for instance, is if you throw a commercial starter into a tank full of must, you're going to have, that's going to take over. All the wild yeasts are just going to be overwhelmed because it reproduces so quickly. One of the things about the business of bread baking that was so sort of touch and go for many, many, many years was that they didn't have commercial yeast. So that the guy who was sort of doing the bread for the neighborhood, if you will, these were all sourdough, naturally leavened breads. And it wasn't until there was commercial brewing. You could go down to the local brewery and grab some of the yeast byproducts from the beer. It wasn't until those kinds of things were available that village bakers were able to get their hands on a consistent commercial yeast product. Hmm. And so, again, you were sort of at the mercy of whatever the gods threw at you in terms of leavening bread. But in the baker's world, if you will, you want to be able to consistently turn out loaves that taste good, that look good. You want them to be able to, for a certain weight of flour and water, sort of look the same on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And that's easy to do and easy to predict with commercial yeast. It's a little harder to do with naturally occurring fermentation. And so, again, you're just sort of guiding things along. You're not trying to take control of a living process.
Right. That's important.
Yeah.
We're going to talk a little bit more about the different types of yeast and how the formula for different breads or different wines will then relate to what yeast you choose to put into that combination. Because I know there's several that you go to depending on what style you're looking to make.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. That was the Brooklyn social scene with Shoreline. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick. I wanted to give a quick thank you to our sponsor, Testo Wines, and to our producer today, Lorenzo Raggiuneri, and engineer, E.J. Dukoski. I'm here this afternoon with Dick Bessie, and we were just speaking about wild and commercial yeasts in winemaking and bread making. And we finished that previous segment with respect to how difficult it is to rely on natural yeast to make a finished product that then you're going to put into the marketplace. And I wanted to also just ask you, Dick, with respect to different varieties of yeast that you would choose to use in bread making or in winemaking. I know there's a formula that the winemaker puts out and there's several different yeast to choose from. And if one doesn't work, maybe you experiment with another. What are those different qualities within the different yeast that would then, you know, have someone choose one to put into a certain formula they're looking for?
Well, in terms of wine, you and I talked about this a little bit at one point. You have various varieties of yeast that give you certain, you're looking for certain characteristics in the way the wine ferments. And I don't think that bread bakers cut it quite that fine. You get, there are sort of different kinds of yeast in terms of their physical state. You can buy fresh yeast in things that look like 1 pound bricks that look like a brick of butter. They're sort of light brown. And
but they don't change the flavor profile? They more are...
Not really. Yeah. Not really. There are people who really like using fresh yeast. I know we use fresh yeast at Roberta's for the pizza dough. And it, if you have a way of keeping it fresh, it is a really good performer. But a lot of places don't have either the refrigeration for it or they don't have the place to store it. There are two kinds of dry yeast. There's a so-called active dry yeast, and then there's an instant dry yeast. And the way they're manufactured, the stuff that's the instant dry yeast works very, very quickly. It is active. It really, really wakes up in a dough. The problem with dried yeasts is that when you dry yeast out, you kill off a lot of them, and these dead yeast cells can cause interesting interactions in breads that give you kind of weird flavors if you're not careful. So I like using fresh yeast, but I don't have too much of a place to keep it. The only real different varieties, in the same way that winemakers use different varieties, is there are yeasts that are specifically tailored for doughs that have a lot of sugar and butter in them. They're called osmotolerant yeasts, and they are slightly different. I have no idea how they make them, and I have no idea how the
chemical makeup is.
Differences between the two yeasts are, but they make making things like croissants easier, and the highly sugared, highly buttered kinds of celebratory breads that the Italians like to make in around Christmas, those kinds of things. So if you are doing those kinds of breads and pastries, those are the sorts of yeast that you tend to gravitate to.
Okay.
But by and large, you can get, if you're, again, if you're careful, you can get away with using just regular yeast in those. But you've got to be fairly careful and keep your eyes open while you're in there. So there really aren't that many different kinds of things that you're not looking for different profiles of fermentation the way you would be in wine. So if somebody said, go get me some yeast, I'm going to make some bread, as a bread maker, I'd say, fine, I'll go get you some yeast.
Right.
As a winemaker, I suspect you'd say, right, boss, which one of these 15 different kinds do I get you?
Right, exactly. Would it be fair to say or assume that some of the ones that the winemaker would choose would be faster to ferment than others?
Probably, yes. Probably so. It would be really interesting to get your hands on a dose of each of these various and sundry kinds of wine yeasts and see what kind of bread you could make.
Right.
Because
yes. Yeah. I've worked with some before that have just smelled like creamed corn.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very strange.
Yeah, no kidding.
When we speak in wine about batonnage or stirring of the lees, so we're stirring the dead yeast cells in the juice to make the wine richer, creamier, kind of off, give it a rounder palate mm-hmm. on the finished product. Mm-hmm. Winemakers, I feel like, are doing that more and more. You know, it's something that lends its a nice quality to the wine because there's a richness there that doesn't necessarily come from heaviness of oak, but rather just an extended lees contact with these yeast cells.
Is this something that you do like periodically, every few hours you go do this?
Yeah.
Or do you
mm-hmm.
have an agitator that sits there doing it constantly, slowly? Or
slowly, mm-hmm. yeah, it's slowly. And I'm sure depending on the style the winemaker is going to want in his finished product, it'll depend on how often they stir or mm-hmm. you know whatnot. But what is it is it possible for you to answer that question as what it is in that yeast that would give off that kind of richness, that complexity?
The only thing that I can think of is if they are actually live yeast cells that you're floating around, you're sort of exposing all of the juice to you're making sure that all of the juice is in contact with whatever amount of yeast you have in there. So that would make some sense that you'd wind up with the entire tank of juice having the same level of fermentation and the same kinds of flavor profiles, mm-hmm. you know, consistent from top to bottom. If I'm working with a bucket full of bread dough, for instance, I do what I call folds, what are the most what bakers call folds, where you are sort of turning the bottom up to the top
sure.
Every hour or so, and partly that keeps the dough compact. Part of it is that it gives the dough structure by stretching things, and part of it is that also makes the dough consistent from one side to the other, the same amount of fermenting going on and mm-hmm. the same amount of yeast concentration through the dough. So it sounds like the same kind of thing is going on. And I don't know how...
It sounds similar. I mean, it is after the fermentation. It's it's been completed. I'm sure that there are still...
Okay.
I'm sure still there are some little guys here and there that haven't necessarily been completed in terms of their ferment, but it is dead yeast cells that are left extended uh-huh. in the juice
okay.
to give this additional sense of creaminess or texture. Yeah, it often lends a little bit of an oiliness where you could tell it's not that toasty oaky. It's like, it's creamy, it's round. I would imagine there's some extended lees contact.
Yeah, that doesn't have an analog in baking that I'm aware of.
Okay. Fair enough. And with respect to health benefits of fermented foods,
mm-hmm.
When we think about Acidophilus or some of those live cultures that are alive and some of the lactic components.
Right.
There's a flora that I guess is created, which helps the bacteria in your own body kind of eliminate toxins and whatnot.
Yeah, you're able to again. It keeps your digestive tract happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to listen to Jamie Lee Curtis advertise yogurt that keeps you regular.
Right.
It's because you've got a culture that. I think we tend to eat things that, for whatever reason, keep the bacterial balance in our bodies completely out of whack. And if you can replenish some of those and in easily digested kinds of foods, and yogurt's pretty easily digested. For a lot of people, I think yogurt is more easily digested than like just straight milk.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are eating foods that you can digest that also have cultures in them that sort of get your digestive tract squared away, then they're healthier for you than things that don't have that kind of fermentation component to them.
And that mostly applies to foods as opposed to wine and beer?
Well, that depends on whether or not you believe in the therapeutic aspects of a good glass of wine once in a while. I think that you probably don't have the same kind of, you know, beneficial bacterial effect, but certainly there is something going on with this red wine effect that people are talking about as a a cardiac health help. And I don't think that's just because after two glasses of wine you've started to relax. And so there's a lot going on there besides just, you know, water and alcohol, all the rest of those compounds that come out of fermentation that aren't there in just raw grape juice.
Right.
Appear to have some real use. So, like they say, that doesn't, you know, that's not to encourage you to set a bottle of wine in front of you when you get home tonight and get out a straw, but a couple glasses of wine appear to be fairly health affirming for a lot of people.
Yes.
And I'm hope I'm one of them.
From what I've understood in our conversations, you are indeed, as am I.
More than likely.
And then I just have one more question for you, for our listeners. When we talk about naturally occurring fermentations that can happen, whether or not they happen in the winery or they happen in the kitchen, for instance, what are the conditions for this? What is it? Temperature? Is it water in bread? Is it, you know, the what are the things that can offset a fermentation?
The things that will help fermentation tend to be sort of warm temperatures more than cold, and a moister environment. If it's bone dry and very cold, it's not going to help you get anything started. The guy in Egypt who set his chunk of dough out next to the Nile is living in a very warm, very humid environment, and those are the kinds of environments that tend to get that kind of, you know, fermentation going. Those are also the kinds of environments that non-beneficial fermentation, you just get rotted food, take place. So some kinds of yeast works better in a given band of temperatures, not real hot, not real cold. And so you, if you're in that sort of temperature range, say around 80 degrees or so and pretty humid, then you can probably kick something off. You get up over about 105 degrees and the yeast just rolls over and dies. And so a kitchen with its fairly high humidity and usual somewhat warmer temperatures is a great place to start those kinds of fermentations. If you want to make some bread, you know, get a starter going, set it up on top of your refrigerator and cover it where it's nice and humid and nice and warm, and away you go.
And I'm sure that there's already some natural fermentations happening in a lot of our refrigerators who haven't cleaned out in a while.
Absolutely.
Or in the shelves.
Yep, absolutely. It's just that if it, you know, there's this rule of thumb, if it really smells bad, you probably don't want to eat it.
Right, exactly.
If it smells pretty good, then you're, you know, welcome to give it a try.
So any new projects on the horizon? I know for our listeners who weren't able to listen last week, we are here out at Roberta's, and there is a new oven that's going to be installed in the backyard, which will be a bread oven,
Like probably 90% bread and 10% pizza. It's going to be something that we're going to bake a lot of bread in, but at night when the bakers go home, and the people that come to Roberta's are hoping for large amounts of pizza, they'll refire that oven and they'll bake pizza in there as well. And we're going to add a little extra square footage outside for a bakery area. And by the time the weather turns cold this fall, we should really have the thing up and running. So I hope
some pumpkin bread coming out of that.
We can have pumpkin bread. We're going to do stuff for the thing that I'm going to start working on actually about now is a set of breads that we can do for the holidays. We'll do some pumpkin kinds of bread and probably things with like persimmons and the like for Christmas. And we'll do some
Little eggnog.
Yeah, that's up
eggnog
to Chris.
Pound
that's up
cake.
To Chris, yeah.
Clearly, I'm putting in my votes.
Okay, but, no, give me. I am open to all kinds of suggestions. People want to tell Heritage Radio Network what they want to see in the bakery out here, then we'll see what we can do.
Great. Well, that's exciting. And thank you again. You've been a wonderful guest. And
well, thank you.
We've learned a lot today, I think, and last week on this whole subject. So
my pleasure. I was glad I could come out and do it.
Okay. Thanks again to our producer, Lorenzo, and engineer, E.J. Dukoski. This is At the Root of It with Aaron Fitzpatrick, and we record live here at Roberta's 4 p.m. every Tuesday. And thanks again to our sponsor, Testa Wines. Look forward to speaking with you next week.
Palm to the palm, you can feel it pounding. Never giving up, you can feel it mounting.